The last few weeks we've been marching through the books of 1st and now into 2nd Kings, and through that talking especially about some of the kings of the northern kingdom of Israel. We've touched on some of the southern kings, but we've kind of marched through. We saw that the northern kings have remained unfaithful to God and in fact continued to get worse and worse, to where we reached the depths of the worst with Ahab. And we talked about that, and we saw how God responded to that by sending his top prophets, okay, sending Elijah and then following him up with Elisha to try to call his people back to him. And we've been looking at that. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, back in Judah, the southern nation, we've got other things going on there as well. And a lot of times as you're marching through the books of the 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Chronicles, it talks about all these kings, and it's real easy to get confused and get them mixed up. So what we want to do is to go through and catch ourselves up a little bit as far as what we've talked about so far on the kings of the northern kingdom and kings of the southern kingdom, and we'll take it a little bit further with the southern kingdom and get caught up there as well. So you can see the title is The Kings of Israel and Judah, and we're not going to cover all of them because we still have more weeks to go through, but we're going to get ourselves caught up to date where we are. And going forward, we'll see, especially in 2 Chronicles, is where we see a lot of information about the southern kings, the kings of the southern nation of Judah. And so we'll get into that. But first, let's talk about before the southern kings, we'll talk about the northern kings. But before that, let's just go all the way back. Go back to the United Kingdom. And when you talk about the kingships and what kind of a king someone was, you know, today when we talk about, well, what kind of a president was somebody? Well, you talk about, you know, was there peace? Was there prosperity? Was there improvements in for the nation? There's a number of things that we look at. But we don't really look at the number one evaluation of what makes a good king and a bad king in God's eyes, and that is faithfulness. Faithfulness to God. The people of Israel were called to be a faithful people. They were called to set an example for the rest of the world on what it meant to be the people of God, what it means to live in a right relationship with God, to live your lives walking in God's footsteps with a heart after God's heart. The kings of God's people, the leaders of God's people, are to set examples and are to encourage, enable, and strengthen the faithfulness of the people, not get in the way, not distract, not turn them away. And so that is the judgment of what makes a good king and what makes a bad king as we talk about the kings of Israel and Judah. So let's go back to the very first king. The very first king was Saul, okay? And we had three kings we saw that had all of Israel under them, okay? Before we had the split between the northern and southern kingdoms, all of the Israelites were under one king, one kingdom called Israel. So how faithful was the first king, Saul? Turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 10, and this is the conclusion of and summary of his thing. It says, verse 13, Saul died because he was unfaithful to Yahweh. He didn't keep the word of Yahweh and even consulted a medium for guidance and did not inquire of Yahweh. So Yahweh put him to death and turned the kingdom over to David, son of Jesse. So Saul did his own thing. He, in the view of whether a faithful king or an unfaithful king, was considered an unfaithful king because he didn't follow God. God came to him and God gave him promises. If you're faithful to me and you follow me and you lead the people to be faithful, then I will bless you and et cetera. But instead, he did his own thing. And we saw that when we talked about his stories. That rather than inquiring of God, rather than looking to God for guidance, rather than looking for God's discernment and what God would want in a situation, he did his own thing. And he even used a medium, it says here. Okay, well, that's the first king. What about the second king, King David? Well, turn to 1 Kings chapter 15, and just verse 5 is kind of a quick little summary. It says that David had done what was right in the eyes of Yahweh and had not failed to keep any of Yahweh's commands all the days of his life, except in the case of Uriah the Hittite. Okay, point of Uriah the Hittite is David was a sinful person, just like we're sinful people. But even despite that sin, he, when confronted with that sin, he repented, he confessed it, repented, and received the consequences of that sin. But all his life, all his reign, he sought the Lord. He looked to God for guidance. He inquired of God. He followed God. He walked in God's footsteps. He had a heart after God's heart. He led the people into faithfulness, not away from faithfulness. And so he is an example for all time of the faithfulness that God wants in his leaders. People today, the Jews today, will look back, and David was the best time, the best king of all of Israel. What about his son? You know, we talked a little bit about the many ways that God blessed his son Solomon, the next king. Was Solomon as faithful to Yahweh as David had been? Chapter 11, verse 4. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to Yahweh as God as the heart of David his father had been. We see that Solomon got a good start, but as he got old, he compromised. As he got older, he got weak. His faith got weak and didn't continue to follow God. In fact, he supported his wives following their gods. In fact, he even worshipped with them. So he turned to other gods because of his many wives, which God had said, don't marry foreign wives. But he had married 700 wives of royal birth, we saw in verse 3 there. So he started strong, but grew weak with age. So far we've got the pinnacle of David. Everything before that was poor, coming back off of David, started strong, but then died off. And it's Solomon's unfaithfulness then that led to the kingdom being split in the first place. We see that also in chapter 11. We'll go to verse 9. It says, the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep Yahweh's command. So Yahweh said to Solomon, since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my command and my decrees, which I've commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you, and I'll give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but I'll give him one tribe for the sake of David my servant and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I've chosen. God's punishment to Solomon for his unfaithfulness was to take the kingdom away and give the kingdom to someone else who could possibly be a faithful leader. But for the sake of the faithfulness of David, he didn't take the whole kingdom. He left a tribe with David's descendants, that is, with Solomon's descendants. So who was this subordinate that God was going to give the bulk of the kingdom to? And what caused this subordinate to pursue the kingdom? Well, going on, verse 26 of chapter 11, it tells us that Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, rebelled against the king, and he was one of Solomon's officials. He is an Ephraimite. And then jumping to verse 29, Jeroboam was going out of Jerusalem, and Ahijah the prophet of Shiloh met him on the way, wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone in the country, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak that he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. And then he said to Jeroboam, take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. See, I'm going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand, and I'll give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David and the city of Jerusalem, which I've chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe. I'll do this because they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Molech, the god of the Ammonites. And they have not walked in my ways, nor done what is right in my eyes, nor kept my statutes and laws as David, Solomon's father, did. Okay. So that was the punishment, and Jeroboam was called by God. God sent this prophet Ahijah to call him to rebel against Solomon, to rebel against Solomon's son Rehoboam. And so he didn't choose it himself, but God instead called him to do it. And we've seen that a few times with some of the kings, that they were called by God to rebel and to be the kings that God had asked them to be. So why did God do this? Why did God pick Jeroboam? Did he just pick Jeroboam because he was one of Solomon's subordinates and through this he was trying to punish Solomon? Or did he intend to bless Jeroboam? Did he have hopes that Jeroboam could be a faithful king? Going on, verse 37. And this is Ahijah still talking with Jeroboam. However, as for you, I'll take you, and you will rule over all that your heart desires. You will be king over Israel. If you do whatever I command you and walk in my ways and do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and commands as David my servant did, I'll be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one that I built for David, and I will give Israel to you. So you see that the promises that he gave to Jeroboam when he called Jeroboam to be king over the northern nation of Israel were the same kind of promises that he had given to Saul, to David, to Solomon, that if you follow me, I will bless you. I will build a dynasty for you. I will build a name for you. Okay? But it's all contingent upon faithfulness, walking in God's footsteps, seeking God's guidance, seeking God's will. Same desire that he has for us as well. All right? So, how faithful was this first king of the northern nation, Jeroboam? Chapter 12, starting in verse 26. Jeroboam thought to himself, the kingdom will now likely revert to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem, they will again give their allegiance to their lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. They'll kill me, and they'll return to King Rehoboam. So after seeking advice, the king made two golden calves. He said to the people, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here's your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. One he set up in Bethel, which is down in the southern part, and the other in Dan, which is way up north in the northern part of Israel. And this thing became a sin. The people went even as far as Dan to worship the one there. Jeroboam built shrines on high places and appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they weren't Levites. And it goes on to say that he even made up festivals and feasts. And basically, he created his own religion. Created his own religion with golden calves to worship, made up priests, made up festivals. So how faithful was Jeroboam as the king of Israel? Not. Okay, he quickly turned from God, created his own religion, did exactly what God did not want a king to do. So, how did God decide to punish Jeroboam for this evil? And you can see God's response to this is indicative of how serious this evil was in God's eyes. This is a number one command. Chapter 14, verse 7. This is Ahijah speaking to Jeroboam's wife and giving her news to tell Jeroboam. It says, go tell Jeroboam that this is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. I raised you up from among the people, and I made you a leader over my people Israel. I tore the kingdom away from the house of David, and I gave it to you. But you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commands and followed me with all his heart, doing only what was right in my eyes. You have done more evil than all who lived before you. You made for yourself other gods, idols made of metal. You provoked me to anger and thrust me behind your back. Because of this, I'm going to bring disaster on the house of Jeroboam. I will cut off from Jeroboam every last male in Israel, slave or free. I will burn up the house of Jeroboam as one burns dung until it's all gone. Dogs will eat those belonging to Jeroboam who die in the city, and the birds of the air will feed on those who die in the country. Yahweh has spoken. Okay? So does this sound like God thought this was a pretty serious sin? Pretty serious revolt by Jeroboam? Yes. Because he was not only going to not continue the dynasty of Jeroboam, he was going to completely destroy and annihilate the name of Jeroboam. Wipe out his entire family. Okay? No one would be left. Not just would there not be a descendant of Jeroboam on the throne, there wouldn't be a descendant of Jeroboam, period. Okay? That was God's judgment. Alright, well, Jeroboam, after he died, who became the next king and how faithful was he? Chapter 15, verse 25 says that Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, became king of Israel in the second year of Asa, king of Judah. Now that's what we've been seeing here too. As we go through these kings, it tells you that so-and-so became the king of Israel. And to give you a date, it tells you who was king of Judah at the time and in what year of his reign. And vice versa, when a Judah king, person becomes a king in Judah, it says during the whatever year of so-and-so, the king of Israel. Okay? And so that's how we're able to keep track of things and create the charts and lists and tables of who was king when. Okay? Now, Nadab, it says here, which Jeroboam's son became the next king. Well, I thought God was going to wipe out Jeroboam's family, but here he allowed the dynasty to continue to the next generation. Well, going on, verse 26, the rest of that, it says, he reigned over Israel 2 years. Okay? So then not much of a reign. And even though it was only 2 years, during those 2 years he did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, walking in the ways of his father, and in his sin, which, it's not just their sin, but which he caused Israel to commit. Again, the king's faithfulness has a lot to say about the faithfulness or lack thereof of the people. And that's why it's so important for the king to be faithful. So, Jeroboam's son, Nadab, became king, just continued the evil ways of his father. He reigned only 2 years. Why? Verse 27, Baasha, the son of Ahijah of the house of Issachar, plotted against him, and he struck him down at Gibbethon, a Philistine town, while Nadab and all of Israel were besieging it. Baasha killed Nadab in the third year of Asa, king of Judah. As soon as he began to reign, he killed Jeroboam's whole family. He did not leave Jeroboam anyone that breathed, but destroyed them all according to the word that Yahweh had given through his servant Ahijah the Shilonite because of the sins that Jeroboam had committed and had caused Israel to commit. And because he had provoked Yahweh, his God, to anger. So Baasha took over. He assassinated Nadab, but not only that, but he totally wiped out Jeroboam's family just as God had said would happen. Okay? Just as was prophesied by Ahijah. So, we now have a new king, a new family, a new opportunity for a faithful king. So, how faithful is this king, Baasha? Chapter 15, again, verse 33. In the third year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha, the son of Ahijah, became king of all of Israel in Tirzah. Tirzah was the capital there at the time of the northern nation. And he reigned for 24 years. He did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, walking in the ways of Jeroboam and in his sin, which he had caused Israel to commit. So how faithful was he? He wasn't. He continued the evil practices of Jeroboam. Okay? Who followed him? 16 verse 8. In the 26th year of Asa, king of Judah, Elah, the son of Baasha, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Tirzah for 2 years. Another 2 year one there. Okay? What happened to Elah? Why did he only reign for 2 years? Verse 9. Zimri, one of his officials who had command of half of his chariots, plotted against him. Elah was in Tirzah at the time, getting drunk in the home of Arsa, the man in charge of the palace at Tirzah. Zimri came in, struck him down, and killed him in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah. Then Zimri succeeded Elah as king. So Elah only ruled for 2 years because he was assassinated by one of his chariot officials. Okay. And so Zimri became king. Now, what was the most important thing for Zimri to do then? Verse 11. As soon as he began to reign and was seated on the throne, He killed off Baasha's whole family. He did not spare a single male, whether relative or friend. So Zimri destroyed the whole family of Baasha in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken against Baasha through the prophet Jehu, which if you look at the beginning of chapter 16, you see that in response to Baasha continuing in the evils of Jeroboam and keeping that religion intact, that God sent Jehu, a prophet, to basically pronounce the same judgment against Baasha, that his family would be wiped out and dogs would eat those belonging to Baasha who die in the city, and birds of the air will feed on those who die in the country. Same thing that we saw for Jeroboam was prophesied and sent. That was a sentence given to Baasha for his faithlessness. And now we see that that's what Zimri did. Zimri fulfilled that. Okay, Zimri completed that. All right, how long did Zimri reign? And why? Okay, verse 15. In the 27th year of Asa, the king of Judah, Zimri reigned in Tirzah 7 days. Okay, this is the shortest king, okay, the shortest term for a king. He reigned in Tirzah for 7 days. Now, why is that? Well, the army was encamped near Gibbethon, which is a Philistine town. When the Israelites in the camp heard that Zimri had plotted against the king and murdered him, they proclaimed Omri, the commander of the army, king over Israel that very day in the camp. Then Omri and all the Israelites with him withdrew from Gibbethon and laid siege to Tirzah. Well, Zimri may be king because he killed the other king and he's now got the right to be the king, but Omri's got a little more power. He's got the army behind him. So he comes and Zimri sees that the cards are stacked against him. So verse 18, when Zimri saw that the city was taken, he went into the citadel of the royal palace and set the palace on fire around him. So he died. Okay. So Zimri lasted 7 days because he committed suicide when he was besieged by the army. And so then, that's Zimri. Okay, who was the next king? Well, you would think Omri, but you know there was a challenge to Omri. Verse 21, it says, the people of Israel were split into two factions. Half of them supported Tibni, the son of Ganath, for king, and the other half supported Omri. So you've got two people. So who's going to win? Well, I love verse 22. It says, but Omri's followers proved stronger than those of Tibni, son of Ganath. So Tibni died, and Omri became king. It's just kind of such a matter-of-fact kind of statement, okay? Now, Omri was stronger, so Tibni died. Yeah, no big surprise there. And Omri became the next king. Now, during Omri's reign, there was one thing that Omri did that lasted for the rest of the life of the northern nation of Israel. And we see that in verse 24. In the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, Omri became king in Israel, and he reigned for 12 years. Now, 6 of those were in Tirzah, but he didn't want to stay in Tirzah. Why not? Well, the palace is no good. It just got burned down, right? Zimri burned the palace down. So he could either rebuild the palace in the city of Tirzah that's been there for a while, or, hey, let's just build a new capital city with a whole new palace and a whole new everything. And that's what he did. Verse 24, he went just a little bit west, just a few miles west, and bought the hill of Samaria from Shemer, a guy named Shemer, for 2 talents of silver, which is like about 150 pounds of silver. So not a whole lot of money for the hill. Why did he get such a price? Well, because he named the city after the guy that he bought it for. So it was more of a donation, I think. And he built a city on this hill and called it Shemaria, or Samaria is the way we pronounce it, after Shemer, the name of the former owner of the hill. Okay, so he built a new capital city and moved the capital to Samaria, and that was where the capital remained for the rest of the existence of the northern nation of Israel. Okay, going on, the next verse also tells us, you know, the natural question we're asking ourselves, how faithful was this King Omri? Verse 25 says, but Omri did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Okay, continuing the Jeroboam thing, right? Well, but it goes on and says, and sinned more than all those before him. He walked in all the ways of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and in his sin, which he caused Israel to commit. Okay? So you see that Omri was even worse than those who preceded him. And you've seen how God's reacted to those who have preceded him. But it's just it's a downward sliding situation here of falling into worse and worse evil. Well, after Omri, who followed him and how faithful was this guy's reign? Verse 29. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, the son of Omri, became king of Israel. And he reigned in Samaria over Israel for 22 years. So a long reign. How about his faithfulness? Ahab, the son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. So you thought Omri was bad, was the worst so far. Ahab took it to a whole new level. In verse 31, it says that he not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. So all this stuff that was so horrible to God of Jeroboam's religion, he saw that as trivial. Oh, that's nothing. Let me show you what else I can do. And what really got him down was the next part. He married Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worship him. Okay, so he did one of these political marriages with the king of Sidon, and she brought her Baal worship with her, and he began to serve Baal, began to worship Baal, and so was the most faithless king. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in the capital city of Samaria. On top of that, he made an Asherah pole. Okay, remember the poles to Asherah. Asherah was the goddess that was Baal's either wife or consort. And he made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke Yahweh, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel before him. Okay, so Ahab was the worst. Ahab was the most unfaithful king ever, worshipped Baal, and pretty much let his wife control a lot of what he did, and she was pretty wicked. Well, you know, the punishments that God had induced on Jeroboam and Baasha's family and the like, well, you think that that's due this family too, and you know, it is. It's common. But what's more important than that? What's more important than punishing the king for being faithless and for leading the people astray? What's more important is God wants the people back to him. Okay? If the king is going to be wicked, at least bring my people back. So what did God do to reach out to the people during this evil time? This is the worst time in Israel's history in terms of faithlessness. Ahab was the absolute worst. So during this depth of evil, depth of rejection of God, this horrible time, what did God do to reach out to the people? Chapter 18, verse 21. In fact, it really kind of starts out in chapter 17. It's the first time we see that Elijah the Tishbite said to Ahab, as Yahweh the God of Israel lives, and he came to him. And so he called Elijah. And we have in chapter 18 this great contest that we looked at as far as the contest between Elijah and the Baal prophets. And in verse 21, we see that he had summoned all the people in verse 19 from all over Israel to meet him on Mount Carmel, and also brought 450 prophets of Baal, and set up this, and the 400 prophets of Asherah, set up this contest. And so when they were all there, they were all assembled, Elijah went before the people in verse 21 and said, "How long will you waver between two opinions?" Okay? Make up your cotton-picking minds. Decide. Okay? If Yahweh is God, then follow him. If Baal is God, then follow him. You cannot worship both God. You cannot worship both Yahweh and Baal. One's God, the other one's not. So you decide. Okay? No man can serve two gods, Jesus said. This is also kind of the calling that Joshua gave the people before he died. And he said, choose today whom you're going to serve. Either you're going to serve the gods of the Canaanites that we came in and wiped out, or serve Yahweh, the one that brought us out of Egypt and gave us these victories and gave us this land and has been always true and faithful to his promises, you decide who you're going to serve. As for me and my house, Joshua said, we're going to serve Yahweh. And so that's the question that was posed by Elijah. God sent Elijah to go and to the people and call them to decide, who is God? Is it Yahweh or is it Baal? Okay. And then we have this big contest that God shows, that Yahweh shows that he is the God, that Baal is not the God. And really the stories that we've had with Elijah before that, you know, Baal was supposed to be the God of rain, but Elijah said, it's not going to rain anymore until Yahweh says it's going to rain. And he showed who's really in control of the rain, who's really in control of this creation. What was Elijah's name? You know, what was Elijah's purpose? Well, his purpose is summed up in his name. And if you look at his name, you see that his name is a contraction of two names, of three words really. El is just a word that means God. Okay, a lowercase g, G-O-D. Okay? And Yah, whenever you see Yah in a name, even like in Jerusalem is Yerushalem, when you see Yah, it's short for Yahweh. Okay? So, Elijah or Eliyah means Yahweh is God. That was his name and that was his purpose. His purpose was to show the people that Yahweh is God. Baal is not God. Nothing else is God. Yahweh is God. And so therefore serve Yahweh. And this contest with the Baal prophets really set that up. And in conclusion of that, verse 39, when all the people saw the results of this contest, okay, they fell prostrate and they cried, Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God. He got the point across. That's what God sent Elijah to do, is to come and remind the people that Yahweh is God. And then we also saw how he followed up Elijah with Elisha, which his name is God is salvation. Okay? And we talked about that. And many different ways that that was shown. So he sent these two prophets during this depth of despair time, this depth of evil and rejection, to call his people back to him. Okay. All right. Well, that was Ahab. Okay. What about who succeeded Ahab and how faithful was his reign? Going on, chapter 22, verse 51. Ahaziah, son of Ahab, became king of Israel and Samaria in the 17th year of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, and he reigned over Israel for 2 years. He did evil in the eyes of Yahweh because he walked in the ways of his father and mother and in the ways of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. He served and worshipped Baal and provoked Yahweh, the God of Israel, to anger just as his father had done. So Ahab's son, Ahaziah, took over and continued the evil ways of his father Ahab. Okay? And the evil ways of his mother Jezebel. Alright? Now, he only lived 2 more years. This wasn't an assassination. Instead, he got hurt. He fell through the upper story, and died from injuries. And so who succeeded him? 2 Kings chapter 1 verse 17, it says, so he died according to the word of Yahweh that Elijah had spoken, because he was unfaithful, okay, because of he had rejected God. Because Ahaziah had no son, so he had no son to succeed him, then Joram, his brother, succeeded him as king in the second year of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. Okay. So very similar names, Joram and Jehoram, so easy to get those confused. But we'll see that the reasons these names are so similar is because there was some intermarrying between the two nations. And you'll see that. You'll even see another Ahaziah and things like that. But this Ahaziah died within 2 years of being king, and his brother Joram Okay. Sometimes you may even see him listed as Jehoram. Okay. He took over. He was also one of Ahab's sons. How faithful do you think Joram was? Chapter 3 says, Joram, the son of Ahab, became king of Israel and Samaria in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and he reigned for 12 years. He did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, but not as his father and mother had done. He did get rid of the sacred stone of Baal that his father had made. But nevertheless, he clung to the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he caused Israel to commit. He did not turn away from them. Okay? So he was better than Ahab, but you know what? That's not saying much. He was still evil in the eyes of the Lord. He continued the evil religion of Jeroboam. Okay? Alright, well, who came next? Chapter 9. We'll zoom through all these chapters that we looked at with Elisha, and a lot of neat stories in there. And we'll go to chapter 9 where we see the next king of Israel. Verse 4. And this is also dealing with Elisha. And Elisha had a prophet, a man from the company of prophets, go to this guy named Jehu, and who was a commander of the army. Okay, so not part of Ahab's family or Joram's family or Ahaziah's family or Omri's family at all. This is a commander. And he went to him in verse 4. The young man, the prophet, went to Ramoth-Gilead, which is where the army was fighting a battle at the time. When he arrived, he found the army officers sitting together. I have a messenger for you, commander, he said. For which one of us? Asked Jehu. For you, commander, he replied. So Jehu got up and went into the house. Then the prophet poured the oil on Jehu's head and declared, this is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. I anoint you king over Yahweh's people, Israel. Okay. So Jehu, one of Joram's army commanders, is the one who became the next king, and he became the next king not because he wanted to, but because God called him to. Okay? He was chosen by God. Now, when this prophet was talking to him, he also told him a very important part of his rule. Verse 7, you are to destroy the house of Ahab your master, and I will avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all the Lord's servants that was shed by Jezebel, Ahab's wife. She killed off a lot of God's prophets. The whole house of Ahab will perish. I will cut off from Ahab every last male in Israel, slave or free. I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah. Okay? So the same judgment that he had for Jeroboam's family being totally wiped out, for Baasha's family being totally wiped out, is what he's got for Ahab's family, or Omri's family, if you want to say that, that Ahab would have no more descendants, period. Not just no descendants on the throne, but no more descendants. Okay? Wipe them clean. So did Jehu accept this task of being the next king and wiping out Ahab's family? Well, the next, you'll have to read this on your own, but from verse 11 on, you've got the story of Jehu. Well, he comes back out. The prophet takes off running. Jehu comes back out, and the other commanders say, hey, what'd that guy want? He said, oh, nothing. He said, no, that's not true. He didn't come here, and he told you something, so tell us. He said, well, he told me he anointed me as king over Israel. So, verse 13, they hurried and took their cloaks and spread them out under them on the bare steps, and they blew the trumpet and shouted, Jehu is king. And then the people there heard that, and he said, okay, if you really want me to be king, or if you agree that I should be king, then don't let anybody leave. I've got to get back to Jezreel, where the king and all that were, before word gets there. So they did, they stopped everybody, then he got into his chariot in verse 16 and rode to Jezreel, because Joram, okay, the king, was resting there, and Ahaziah, now this is a different Ahaziah, this is an Ahaziah that's king of Judah, the southern nation, was there with him, okay? But they're related, and we'll talk about that when we talk about the kings of Judah, in a little bit. So he comes, and you get this interesting thing that Joram sends out messengers to say, hey, what are you coming here for, Jehu? Are you coming in peace? And when the messenger gets there, he says, hey, what do you have to do about peace? Fall in behind me. So the messenger falls in behind. So he sends another messenger, and on like that. Finally, Jehu and Ahaziah get in their own chariots and go out to meet him. And he says, Jehu, verse 22, have you come in peace? Jehu replies, how can there be peace as long as the idolatry and witchcraft of your mother Jezebel abound? So Joram knows what's going on here. Ahaziah takes off. Jehu shoots an arrow and hits Joram between the shoulders, and it kills him immediately, hits his heart. And then he also sends people to go and to get Ahaziah. And so they go, and it says in verse 27 that they wounded him, and he escaped to Megiddo and died there. So both of the kings of the northern nation of Israel and the king of the southern nation of Judah, were killed, both of them being descendants of Ahab. So you see that he did accept his role to wipe out the family of Ahab. And going on, the rest of chapter 9 is interesting. He gets to Jezreel, and Jezebel is there, and here's what's happened. And I like verse 31, it says, as Jehu entered the gate, she asked him, have you come in peace, Zimri? Okay, she calls him Zimri. Who was Zimri? He was the guy who killed the king and thought he would be king, but only lasted 7 days. He says, have you come in peace, Zimri, you murderer of your master? And so he looked up, and she was up in the upper window, and he called up and said, hey, is anybody on my side up there? And a couple of two or three eunuchs looked down at him, and he said, hey, if you're on my side, throw her down. So they did. They threw her down. She came tumbling out of the window and died when she landed there on the ground. And then he went on in to eat, and everybody went in to eat. And while he was eating, he said, hey, she's the daughter of a king, so go back and bury her. And they went out to bury her, and they found nothing except her skull, her feet, and her hands. And that confirmed the word that Elijah had said before, that on the plot of ground at Jezreel, dogs will devour Jezebel's flesh. Her body will be like refuse on the ground in the plot at Jezreel, so that no one will be able to say that this is Jezebel. So you see that that was fulfilled there. And then in chapter 10, you've got there were 70 sons of the house of Ahab in Samaria. So Jehu has them killed. They're all beheaded, and you get the little story in there by the people in charge of the city, and they send them to him. Then you also have later, verse 12, he just runs into some relatives of Ahaziah, the king of Judah, and they don't know what's going on. And he says, hey, here are y'all. And he says, oh, we're relatives of Ahaziah, and we've come down to greet the family of the king and the queen mother. Well, they don't know that they've been killed yet. And so he has them slaughtered. And so you see in conclusion of all this, chapter 10, verse 11 says, Jehu killed everyone in Jezreel who remained in the house of Ahab, as well as all of his chief men, his close friends, and his priests, leaving him no survivors. And then verse 17, when Jehu came to Samaria, okay, the capital city, he killed all who were left there of Ahab's family. He destroyed them according to the word of Yahweh spoken to Elijah. Okay. So the judgment that God had on Ahab's family, Jehu took care of. All right? Now, Jehu now was new king, new dynasty, new family, new fresh opportunity to turn things faithful, and to turn Israel faithful and have a faithful kingship. So how faithful of a king was Jehu? Verse 18. Then Jehu brought all the people together and said to them, Ahab served Baal a little, Jehu will serve him much. Now summon all the prophets of Baal, all his ministers and all his priests. See that no one is missing, because I'm going to hold a great sacrifice for Baal. Anyone who fails to come will no longer live. Okay? What's interesting is Jehu was acting deceptively in order to destroy the ministers of Baal. And you've got this story here then, that what he's doing is he's saying anybody who's a priest or a minister for Baal come to this great celebration. If you don't come, then you're not a priest of Baal and you will die. It's, Ahab served Baal a lot. I'm going to serve him even more. So he got them all there. They all came into this temple. He provided each of them with a special robe for the occasion. He goes in to offer a sacrifice. He burns this sacrifice in the temple. And then he walks out and he's got soldiers stationed all around the temple. And he gives a sign and they all go rushing in and they kill off all the Baal priests and wipe out the Baal priests there. Verse 24. Jehu had posted 80 men outside with this warning, if any one of you lets any of the men that I'm placing in your hands escape, it will be your life for his life. So making sure that they got them all. As soon as Jehu had finished making the burnt offering, he ordered the guards and officers, go in and kill him, let no one escape. So they cut him down with the sword. The guards and officers threw their bodies out and then entered the inner shrine of the temple of Baal. They brought the sacred stone out of the temple of Baal and burned it. Okay, it's a pretty hot fire to burn a stone. They demolished the sacred stone of Baal and tore down the temple of Baal, and people have used it for a latrine to this day. Okay, just very fitting for what to do with the Baal temple property there. So Jehu destroyed Baal worship in Israel. Okay. So you see he did good there. However, verse 29, he did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit, the worship of the golden calves at Bethel and Dan. So he got rid of the Baal worship, but he didn't get rid of the idolatry that Jeroboam had started. This has continued on for all these years, all these kings, all these different families of kings, and they're still continuing in Jeroboam's sins. Okay? So, how did God respond to Jehu's faithfulness? Well, he was faithful in terms of what he did to destroy Baal worship. How did God respond to that? Verse 30 says, the Lord said to Jehu, because you've done well in accomplishing what is right in my eyes and have done to the house of Ahab all that I had in mind to do, your descendants will sit on the throne of Israel to the fourth generation. Why not a promise of forever? Because Jehu was not faithful and did not wipe out Jeroboam's religion. Okay? So he blessed him with descendants to the fourth generation because of what he did to wipe out Baal worship. But he left Jeroboam worship there. Okay? Next week we'll pick up from there on the descendants of Jehu and continue on with the kings of Israel. But now let's stop and go backwards again and let's look at the kings of Judah. So we've looked at the kings of the northern nation of Israel. And what have we seen there? We've seen that so far all of them are evil. It all started with Jeroboam making up this religion, and every king since then has followed in those sins and has continued in those sins. And you see, what's God's judgment been on these kings that do that? He's wiped them out. None of them have descendants that exist today. None of them have descendants that existed a few generations later. They were totally wiped out. Jeroboam's dynasty was wiped out. Baasha's dynasty was wiped out. Well, you got Zimri that only lasted for 7 days. Omri's dynasty was wiped out and family was wiped out. So you see the judgments there. Okay, so far we've got how many dynasties? You've got Jeroboam, you've got Baasha, you have Zimri, you have Omri, and now you've got Jehu. So we've got 5 dynasties at this point. Okay, and we're not done yet. We still have more that we'll be going into in the coming weeks. Well, let's turn to Judah. How many dynasties did Judah have during the same time? In fact, let's just kind of stretch it out and say, how many dynasties did Judah have ever? 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 34. And this is when Ahijah is speaking for God to Jeroboam and calling Jeroboam. And he says, I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I've made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of, not of him, but for the sake of his of David, my servant, whom I chose and who observed my commands and my statutes. I will take the kingdom from his son's hands, and I will give you 10 tribes. I will give 1 tribe to his son, so that David, my servant, may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I chose to put my name. So how many dynasties? 1. All the kings of Judah, okay, were descendants of David. All part of David's family. Did they deserve to be? Well, we're going to see as we go through the kings of Judah that not all of them were faithful. But because of the faithfulness of their ancestor, David, they were blessed, despite their sinfulness. Unfaithfulness on a person's part can carry forward into future generations, but also faithfulness on a person's part can carry forward into future generations. So what are you doing to carry faithfulness forward into future generations for your descendants? There's not a king in Israel right now, right? So how did God keep his promise for all of eternity? He said that David would always have a light, would always have a descendant on the throne. Turn to Matthew 22, and this is kind of a question that Jesus asked to the Pharisees, who are people who are very studied in the Scriptures. He said, while the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them, what do you think about the Christ, the Messiah? Whose son is he? Oh, well, he's the son of David, they replied. Well, he said, well, how is it then that David, speaking by the Spirit, calls him Lord? For he says, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put my enemies under your feet. Well, if David calls him Lord, then how can he be his son? Okay, and the Pharisees couldn't figure that one out. The point of that is that Jesus is the king that is reigning today and reigning forever on David's throne. Jesus is the descendant of David who continues to reign on the throne. In fact, you see that in Mark chapter 15, verse 2, when Pilate asked Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus said, yep, it's as you say. Okay, so even Jesus said that he is the king. All right, so let's start looking at the lineage of these kings. And we'll pull a lot of this from 2 Chronicles, because we'll get more detail on the southern nation of Judah from the Chronicles than we do from the Kings, the Book of the Kings. So how faithful was the first king of the southern nation, Rehoboam? He was Solomon's son. 2 Chronicles chapter 12. After Rehoboam's position as king was established and he had become strong, he and all of Israel with him abandoned the law of Yahweh. So again, we've seen this before. He started strong, just like his father, but he finished weak. In fact, he fell away early. His strong start didn't last anywhere like as long as his father's strong start. So once he felt that his position was established, he abandoned God. So how did God punish Judah for Rehoboam's unfaithfulness? Verse 2, because they had been unfaithful to Yahweh, Shishak, the king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem in the 5th year of King Rehoboam. And you see, he comes in those next verses and destroys and captures the fortified cities of Judah. And it's just mopping up on the southern nation, destroying it. And he comes to Jerusalem. And then a prophet comes to Rehoboam and the leaders of Judah and says, you know, since you've abandoned God, God's abandoning you to Shishak. And then verse 6, the leaders of Israel and the king humbled themselves and said, Yahweh is just. You know, he's right. We have and we deserve this. And then because of that, God saw that they humbled themselves and decided and said that because they've humbled themselves, I will not destroy them, but I'm going to make them subject to Shishak so they can see the difference between serving me and serving a man. And so what you see in verse 9 then is that Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem and he carried off all the treasures of the temple and the treasures of the royal palace, everything, including the gold shields that Solomon had made. So all this great stuff that Solomon had put into the temple and David had prepared for the temple, it's all gone to Egypt then. And so that's the discipline, the judgment that God had as a result of Rehoboam's unfaithfulness. Okay. So who followed him then? Who succeeded Rehoboam as king of Judah and how faithful is he? Chapter 15 of back in 1 Kings. So we're back to 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 1. In the 18th year of the reign of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, Abijah became king of Judah. Okay? He committed all the sins his father had done before him. His heart was not fully devoted to Yahweh his God as the heart of David his forefather had been. So Abijah was not faithful. Now you see in verse 2 that he reigned for only 3 years. And then who took over? Verse 9. In the 20th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Asa became king of Judah. And in verse 11, Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done. He expelled the male shrine prostitutes from the land and got rid of all the idols that his fathers had made. So you see, he reverses the downward slide, okay, and brings Israel back to faithfulness. So much so that in verse 13, he even deposed his grandmother Maacah from her position as queen mother because she had made a repulsive Asherah pole. Asa cut the pole down and burned it in the Kidron Valley, which is right east of, that's the valley right east of Jerusalem. Okay? So you see that Asa, the son of Abijah, became king, and he did right like David. He enacted reforms and brought Israel back to faithfulness. Okay? Even deposed his grandmother. How serious was Asa about returning Israel to faithfulness? Well, let's turn to 2 Chronicles. We can get a little bit more detail from there. 2 Chronicles chapter 15, starting at verse 10, says, "They assembled in Jerusalem in the third month of the 15th year of Asa's reign. At that time they sacrificed to Yahweh 700 head of cattle and 7,000 sheep and goats from the plunder that they had brought back. They entered into a covenant to seek Yahweh, the God of their fathers, with all their heart and soul. All who would not seek Yahweh, the God of Israel, were put to death, whether small or great, man or woman." Does that sound like serious reforms? Yeah. "They took an oath to Yahweh with loud acclamation, with shouting and with trumpets and horns. All of Judah rejoiced about the oath because they had sworn it wholeheartedly." This wasn't just something they were going through the motions. They were serious about returning to faithfulness. "They sought God eagerly," it says, "and he was found by them." Seek and you will find, Jesus says. So Yahweh gave them rest on every side. So they sought God, they followed him, they turned back to faithfulness, and God in turn blessed them just as he promised. So we see that Asa made this great sacrifice. He made people decide, are you for Yahweh or not? And if not, bye. And the whole nation then made this covenant to follow God wholeheartedly. Right? So a very faithful king, and reversed a lot of the negatives that the kings before him had put into place. All right, who came next? Chapter 17. Jehoshaphat, his son, succeeded him as king and strengthened himself against Israel. Okay, there's some fighting against Israel, and he stationed some troops and all that. It says that Yahweh was with Jehoshaphat because in his early years, he walked in the ways his father David had followed. Okay, he did not consult the Baals, but sought the God of his father and followed his commands rather than the practices of Israel. So you see that Jehoshaphat, the son of Asa, started out just like his father and started out faithful, continuing to build the faithfulness of the people of Israel, just like David. Okay, but it says there in his early years. So what does that kind of tell you? Something changes later, and we'll see that. All right. Now, the reforms that Asa had put into place, Jehoshaphat took it a little further, at least in his early years. Verse 7, it says that in the third year of his reign, he sent these officials to teach in the towns of Judah. And verse 9, they taught throughout Judah, taking with them the book of the law of Yahweh. They went around to all the towns of Judah and taught all the people. So he sent priests and teachers to go around and leaders to go around all of Judah and teach the people the law. Okay? So they took the Pentateuch with them. They took the Bible with them and taught the people the law. People didn't have Bibles. They didn't have Gutenberg yet. So you see that he went and actively tried to spread faithfulness throughout the nation. You also see, if you backtrack to verse 6, it says that his heart was devoted to the ways of the Lord. Furthermore, he removed the high places and the Asherah poles from Judah. He's continuing reforms here. You also see that in chapter 19, he did some things to help make sure this would continue. Because just by sending the leaders out and the priests out to teach the people, you know, once they leave, are they going to go backwards? So in chapter 19, verse 4, you know, Jehoshaphat lived in Jerusalem, and he went out again among the people from Beersheba down the south to the hill country of Ephraim in the north, and turned them back to Yahweh, the God of their fathers. And then in all these cities, he appointed judges in the land in each of the fortified cities of Judah. He told them, consider carefully what you do, because you're not judging for man, but for Yahweh, who is with you whenever you give a verdict. Now let the fear of Yahweh be upon you. Judge carefully, for with Yahweh our God there is no injustice or partiality or bribery. So he appointed judges and commanded them to be faithful and set them in place based on being faithful to God. So how did God respond to all this? How did God bless Jehoshaphat for his faithfulness? Back to 17, verse 5, it says that Yahweh established the kingdom under Jehoshaphat's control, and all of Judah brought gifts to Jehoshaphat so that he had great wealth and great honor. Okay, so you see that he gave him great wealth, gave him great honor. And then verse 10, the fear of Yahweh fell on all the kingdoms of the land surrounding Judah so that they did not make war with Jehoshaphat. So he gave him peace. Some Philistines brought Jehoshaphat gifts and silver as tribute, and the Arabs brought him flocks, 7,700 rams and 7,700 goats. Okay, so he was given wealth from outside as well, including this tribute from the Philistines and the Arabs. So he was given peace, wealth, honor, power as a result of his faithfulness. Okay, seems like should be kind of obvious, right? If you're a king of Israel, king of God's people, if you're faithful to God, God will bless you and the nation, right? That's the way to go. All right. Well, there was this civil strife. Ever since the time of Rehoboam and Jeroboam, there had been civil strife in the land between the northern nation and the southern nation. And Jehoshaphat did something that ended that. Chapter 18. Now, Jehoshaphat had great wealth and honor, and he allied himself with Ahab by marriage. Okay? So he did one of these political marriages. Now, he didn't get married to part of Ahab's family, but instead he married off his son, okay, Jehoram, to Ahab's daughter, Athaliah. Bad, bad move. Okay? It may bring peace between the two nations, but it sure brings horrible evil into the faithful nation of Judah. Look at all the good that Asa and Jehoshaphat have done, and now you bring in Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. What kind of person do you think Athaliah is? What kind of influence do you think Athaliah might have on this nation of Israel, of Judah, trying to be faithful to Yahweh? It was tough. Now, it wasn't just this marriage. Okay, he took other steps, more direct than a political marriage. In verse 3, you can see in verse 2 that some years later, Jehoshaphat went down to visit Ahab in Samaria. So they made friends here. Okay, Ahab, the king of Israel, in verse 3, asked Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, will you go with me against Ramoth-Gilead? Okay, which had been an Israelite town, but had been conquered and taken by the Syrians or by the Arameans. Jehoshaphat said, I am as you are, my people as your people. We will join you in the war. So you see, he allied himself and with Ahab, joined Ahab in battle against the Arameans at Ramoth-Gilead. If you turn back to 2 Kings chapter 3, this is later on, okay, under Joram, the descendant of Ahab, sent this message to Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat was still king of Judah and said, the king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go with me to fight against Moab? Jehoshaphat says, I'll go with you. I am as you are. My people is your people. My horses is your horses. So he allied with Joram in battle against Moab in the desert of Edom. He may have stopped the civil war, but he sure, by making friends with the northern nation. But this was during the deepest, most evil, most godless, faithless time of the northern kingdom. So what does that do to the southern kingdom? What does God think about this? What does God think about Jehoshaphat's alliance with Israel? Now we'll look at a couple of them. Chapter 19 of 2 Chronicles, verse 2, we see that Jehu, the seer, not the king that we've talked about, the son of Hanani, went out to meet Jehoshaphat and said to the king, "Should you help the wicked and love those who hate Yahweh? Because of this, the wrath of Yahweh is upon you." Okay? Why are you making friends and why are you supporting and intermixing with the greatest enemies that God has here? Okay? With those who hate Yahweh. Because you've done so, God is mad at you and God's wrath will be upon you. In verse 20, you can see, or chapter 20, verse 35 to 37, you can see a practical result of this. You see that Jehoshaphat made an alliance with Ahaziah, the king of Israel. Okay, later on, the one we left off with, I believe. No, is the son of Ahab there, who was guilty of wickedness. He agreed with him to construct a fleet of trading ships. After these were built at Ezion-Geber, Eleazar, the son of Dodavahu of Merishah, prophesied against Jehoshaphat, saying, "Because you have made an alliance with Ahaziah, Yahweh will destroy what you have made." So the ships were wrecked and were not able to set sail to trade. Okay. So you see that God, the faithfulness, Jehoshaphat started so well. He took the reforms of his father Asa and took him even farther. And now he's going backwards by making friends with Ahab and bringing Ahab's daughter into his family. And all of that. And so you see God is not happy with that. So what does that say about the friends that we keep? What does that say about the people that we ally ourselves with, that we intermix with, that we associate ourselves with, that we support? Okay? Are we supporting those who reject God and hate God? All right. Well, who came after Jehoshaphat? Okay? Chapter 21, verse 5. Jehoram was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 8 years. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, not the ways of the kings of Judah, not the ways of his father Jehoshaphat or his grandfather, okay? But in the ways of the kings of Israel, just as the house of Ahab had done. So he walked in the ways of the worst of the kings of Israel. Why? Because he had married a daughter of Ahab. Athaliah, his wife, was a daughter of Ahab. This is the marriage that Jehoshaphat had made to bring alliance between the two nations. Okay? And as a result, when Jehoshaphat was gone, things started sliding during Jehoshaphat's time, but now they really went bad. Okay? And now we have a period of Baalism, people worshiping Baal, in Judah. Okay? In the southern nation. It's supposed to be the faithful, where the faithful ones are. What's the first sign that we see of Jehoram's faithlessness here? Verse 4, when Jehoram had established himself firmly over his father's kingdom, he put all of his brothers to the sword, along with some of the princes of Israel. Okay, so he went out. This is not something that the family of God's leaders do, but he went out and wiped out his family, so that there wouldn't be any threats to his kingship. Okay? Where did he get an idea like that? From his in-laws. Okay? This is the kind of thing Ahab's family would do. So how did God punish Jehoram for his faithlessness? Now there's a number of ways. Verse 8. In the time of Jehoram, Edom rebelled against Judah and set up its own king. Okay? Up until this time, Edom had been a vassal, had been subject to Judah. But now they rebelled, set up their own king. So Jehoram went there with his officers and all his chariots. The Edomites surrounded him and his chariot commanders, but Jehoram rose up and broke through by night. To this day, Edom has been in rebellion against Judah, and also Libna revolted at the same time because Jeroboam had forsaken Yahweh, the God of his fathers. So God allowed Edom and Libna to rebel against Judah as a result of the faithlessness of Jehoram. Okay. Verse 16. Well, and actually going on, verse 11 too. It says, he had built high places on the hills of Judah and caused the people of Jerusalem to prostitute themselves and had led Judah astray. Okay. There's a picture of Jehoram's reign. And then Jehoram in verses 12 through 15 receives a letter from Elijah. Okay. Elijah the prophet who's up in the north, he sends a letter and says, this is what God says to you. You have rejected God. You have turned Judah away from God just as Ahab has done the north. So as a result, God is going to, verse 14, strike your people, your sons, your wives, and everything that is yours with a heavy blow. Okay? So he's going to wipe them out. And as for you, you yourself will be very ill with a lingering disease of the bowels until the disease causes your bowels to come out. And you see that in verse 19 and 18. That God afflicts him with an incurable disease of the bowels in the course of time at the end of the second year. So he has this horrible pain and suffering for 2 years, and then his bowels come out because of the disease, and he dies in great pain. And the people make no fire in his honor as they had for his fathers. So you see this painful death from a bowel disease, and he passed away to no one's regret. Okay, verse 20, you see there. Also, verse 16 and 17, we see that the hostility of the Philistines and the Arabs, God aroused that against Jehoram, and they attacked Judah, invaded it, and carried off all the goods found in the palace together with his sons and wives. Not a son was left to him except for Ahaziah, the youngest. So just as Elijah had prophesied, his family was taken, and then they were killed off, we see elsewhere, by these raiders. And so he lost his family, he lost his health, and had 2 years of very painful suffering as a result of his faithlessness in turning Judah astray. All right, who came next? Well, I think you know, because he only had one son that was remaining after the raiders. In chapter 22, the people of Jerusalem made Ahaziah, Jehoram's youngest son, the king in his place, since the raiders who had come with the Arabs into the camp had killed all the older sons. So Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of Judah, began to reign. And in verse 2, it says that he reigned for 1 year. Verse 3, how faithful was he? He too walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother, Athaliah, encouraged him in doing wrong. He did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, as the house of Ahab had done, for after his father's death, they became his advisors to his undoing. So he looked to the house of Ahab, the people in the north, the worst kings that Israel had ever seen. He looked to them for advice. He says, all part of that family. So you see the intermixing that Jehoshaphat had done by bringing Ahab's daughter into his family just screwed things up for his family as well as screwed things up for Judah. Okay? Now, why did he reign such a short time? Verse 7. Through Ahaziah's visit to Joram, God brought down Ahaziah's downfall. So if you remember that Joram was the king of Israel, and he had been wounded, okay, which you can kind of see some of that when he went and fought Ramoth-Gilead in the previous verses. And so he went to visit him. And while he was visiting him, when Ahaziah arrived, he went out with Joram to meet Jehu, the son of Nimshi. So while Joram was recovering from his injuries and Ahaziah was visiting him, that's when we see that story of Jehu being called by God to purge Ahab's house and to destroy everybody in Ahab's house. And this is the story we talked about, that Jehu's coming into town at Jezreel, and Joram and Ahaziah go out to meet him. Jehu kills with an arrow Joram, and Ahaziah runs away, but he's caught up and injured and ends up dying. Okay. So that's why he lives so short. He was killed by Jehu in the purge of Ahab's family while he was visiting his uncle Joram. All right. Who's next? Well, next is Athaliah. Well, who's Athaliah? Well, look back at verse 2 of chapter 22. It says, Ahaziah was 22 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 1 year. His mother's name was Athaliah. She is a granddaughter of Omri, a daughter of Ahab. So Athaliah was Ahaziah's mom. Okay. She was Jehoram's wife. She was Jehoshaphat's daughter-in-law. Okay. Ahab's daughter. And now she then took charge. She was kind of the queen mother. And so when Ahaziah died by Jehu, she took over. And verse 10, what did she do? When Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she proceeded to destroy the whole royal family of the house of Judah. So she tried to purge David's line, killed off the royal family, said, okay, no more will any of David's descendants be on the throne. She even kills her own children, grandchildren kind of people here. Okay? But remember God's promise to David is that he would always have a descendant on the throne. So how would that happen if Athaliah destroys the line? Verse 11. But Jehoshaphat, the daughter of King Jehoram, okay? Jehoshaphat, the daughter of King Jehoram, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah. Okay, so Joash was the son of Ahaziah, the grandson of Athaliah. Okay, and Athaliah wants to kill him because he's a descendant of David and she's wiping all them out. And she stole him away from among the royal princes who were about to be murdered, because there are a bunch of others, and put him and his nurse in a bedroom. Okay. Now, because Jehoshaphat, the daughter of King Jehoram and wife of the priest of Jehoiada, was Ahaziah's sister, she hid the child from Athaliah so she could not kill him. So you get a lot of connections here, okay? And I know it could be hard to follow, but Joash was Ahaziah's son. He would be one in line there after Ahaziah. Athaliah is in the process of trying to kill them all off. So Ahaziah's sister, Jehoshaphat, now she is married to Jehoiada, who is the high priest at the time. So she hides him in the temple. We don't see it in that verse, but we'll see that. We see it elsewhere. So we see, and then in verse 12, that Joash remains hidden with Jehoiada and Jehoshaphat for 6 years while Athaliah ruled the land. So Athaliah was queen and ruled the land of Judah for 6 years. Okay, so there was no king, there was a queen. And this queen was not part of David's family, right? She was a daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. And so what do you think the faithlessness or faithfulness was like during that time? Okay, this was the bottom part of the life of the nation of Judah. Okay, so what happened after those 6 years? In the seventh year, verse 1 of chapter 23, Jehoiada showed his strength. He made a covenant with the commanders of units of 100. They went throughout Judah and gathered the Levites and the heads of the Israelite families from all the towns. When they came to Jerusalem, the whole assembly made a covenant with the king at the temple of God. Jehoiada said to them, "The king's son shall reign as Yahweh promised concerning the descendants of David." Now, this is what you're to do. And so he puts this this thing in place to where he's going to put Joash as king. He's only 7 years old, but it's time for him to be king. And anyone who opposes him will be killed. And then verse 11, Jehoiada and his sons brought out the king's son and put the crown on him. They presented him with a copy of the covenant and proclaimed him king. They anointed him and shouted, "Long live the king." So in verse 11, Jehoiada and his sons were responsible for putting Joash in his rightful spot on the throne and returning the throne to David's descendants here. Okay? All right, so what then happened to Athaliah when he did this? Verse 12, when Athaliah heard the noise of the people running and cheering the king, she went to them at the temple of the Lord. And then verse 15, we'll zoom to that. They seized her as she reached the entrance of the horse gate on the palace grounds, and there they put her to death. Okay, so she came to check it out. She saw it. She shouted treason in verse 13, and they went and they killed her. So her threat is gone. Now, how was Athaliah responsible for her own fate? Well, if you turn back, you know, see what Jesus said back in Matthew chapter 26, verse 52. This is when Peter draws his sword in the garden. And Jesus says, put your sword back in its place to Peter, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. And that's what happened to Athaliah. Okay, now, so how old was Joash? Joash is now king. How old is he when he becomes king, and how faithful is his reign? Chapter 24, verse 1. Joash was 7 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 40 years. So he reigned till he was 47, but how could he reign at seven? How could a seven-year-old kid be king? Well, going on, verse 2, Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all the years of Jehoiada the priest. And so what we have a picture of here then is Jehoiada really did the ruling. Okay, he reigned and he guided and instructed Joash what to do. And as long as Jehoiada was around, the nation of Judah was ruled faithfully, and was brought back to faithfulness. The horrible evils that were brought in by Athaliah and Ahaziah were reversed, and Baal worship was removed. And all the time that Jehoiada was around, Joash ruled faithfully. Okay. What was one of the things that Joash did that showed Judah's faithfulness? In fact, this one here you kind of see is really, if you look at the whole story, this was Joash's action, not Jehoiada's, but he got it, at least during this time. Okay, verse 4, sometime later Joash decided to restore the temple of Yahweh. And then we'll zoom down to 13. The men in charge of the work were diligent, and the repairs progressed under them. They rebuilt the temple of God according to its original design and reinforced it. So you see that on his own accord, he raised money, and that's what you can see in the middle verses there, is he called for a reinstitution of the tax that Moses had imposed to help provide funds for the tent of testimony. And people said great, and they happily paid that tax, and that money, those contributions came in and paid for the materials and the labor and all to rebuild the temple and to restore the temple and return it to its glory. Okay, and that happened under Joash. All right, what happened then after Jehoiada died? Verse 17. After the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and paid homage to the king, and he listened to him. They abandoned the temple of Yahweh, the God of their fathers, and they worshipped Asherah poles and idols. Oh, when are they going to learn? Because of their guilt, God's anger came upon Judah and Jerusalem. Although Yahweh sent prophets to the people to bring them back to him, and though they testified against him, they would not listen. So after Jehoiada died, and it was then just left to Joash, he abandoned God. The leaders abandoned God. He worshipped idols. The people worshipped idols. They ignored the prophets. And Judah went downward again. Okay. Well, Jehoiada had sons, right? We saw that earlier. One of the sons came and pointed out this problem. And that's what you see in verse 20. The Spirit of God came upon Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada the priest. He stood before the people and said, "This is what God says. Why do you disobey Yahweh's commands? You will not prosper. Because you have forsaken Yahweh, he has forsaken you." Okay, he's judging against you. But in response to that, they plotted against him, and by order of the king, by order of Joash, they killed him. They stoned him to death in the courtyard of the temple. Okay, that was one of the boys that Joash grew up with. Okay, one of the sons of Jehoiada, Joash grew up with him. And on top of that, Joash did not remember the kindness that Zechariah's father Jehoiada had shown him, but killed his son, who said as he lay dying, "May Yahweh see this and call you to account." So you see the evil that Joash had turned to here. Forgot everything that God had done for him through Jehoiada, and even had Jehoiada's son killed when his sin was pointed out, when his evil was pointed out. Not only did Joash reject God by worshiping other gods. But even in times of trouble, he didn't turn to God. For instance, take a look back at 2 Kings chapter 12, starting at verse 17. At this time, Hazael, king of Aram, went up and attacked Gath, which is a Philistine town, and captured it. Then he turned to the next big city that he had sights on, which was Jerusalem. But Joash, the king of Judah, took all the sacred objects that were dedicated by his fathers Jehoshaphat, Jehoram, and Ahaziah, the kings of Judah, and the gifts that he himself had dedicated back during Jehoiada's time, and all the gold that was found in the treasuries of the temple of Yahweh and of the royal palace, and he sent them to Hazael, king of Aram, who then withdrew from Jerusalem. So rather than turning to God for help when he was attacked by an enemy, he gave the temple treasures, he gave the treasures that were devoted to God to the enemy to buy freedom. What does God do in response? This is the leader of God's people, so God acts. How was Joash punished for his faithlessness? Back to 2 Chronicles chapter 24, beginning at verse 23. It says, at the turn of the year, the army of Aram marched against Joash and invaded Judah and Jerusalem and killed all the leaders of the people. They sent all the plunder to their king in Damascus. Although the Aramean army had come with only a few men, Yahweh delivered into their hands a much larger army. Because Judah had forsaken Yahweh, the God of their fathers, judgment was executed on Joash. When the Arameans withdrew, they left Joash severely wounded. His officials conspired against him for murdering the son of Jehoiada the priest, and they killed him in his bed. So he died and was buried in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the kings. Okay? So he was wounded by the Syrians and assassinated by officials. So Joash had a good start, but turned evil. Kind of like Solomon, kind of like Rehoboam, but this one, he really turned evil. And he forgot a key lesson that God wants us all to remember. A lesson for us as well. Turn to Matthew chapter 10, verse 22 says, Jesus says, all men will hate you because of me, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved. He who stands firm to the end will be saved. So it's not necessarily how well we start out, it's how well we continue. It's how well we finish. Okay? Paul talks a lot about that, about finishing strong. If we are faithful to the end, if we do finish well, finish faithful with hearts after God's hearts, then what reward do we have promised to us? Revelation chapter 2, second half verse 10, it says, be faithful, even to the point of death, and I will give you the crown of life. Okay, so we'll receive the crown of life. That is eternal life, salvation, being with God forever, living forever with God. Let's pray. God our Father, it sure seems like these people in Israel, the kings of Israel, the kings of Judah, it was too obvious that all they had to do was follow you and be faithful to you, but they wouldn't. They continued to turn away from you, continued to reject you and worship other gods. You punished them to drive them back to you. You called them back to you. You blessed them when they were faithful. But yet they still turned away from you. But you know, we do the same. The same calling that you gave to them to be faithful. The same promises of blessing us when we're faithful. The same judgments of punishment when we stray. All of that goes for us as well. And yet we still turn from you. And for that, we're very sorry. We ask for your forgiveness. We repent of those sins. Help us to take the strength of your Spirit to withstand the temptations that Satan sends to us, to drive us away from you, to lead us to worship other gods. You know, gods in our days of money, of television, of other ideas and philosophies and gods that may be before us. Forgive us for that, and help us to be strong through the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.